Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
Well, after your, I thought, very nice small tribute to Joe Cox last week, we thought that we'd come and do an early pre-EU referendum podcast, because obviously there's no point us sounding off and putting it out on Thursday when people will be still be voting and it's immediately outdated. So a special early episode of the New Statesman podcast this week. Let's talk about Joe Cox's death. Obviously, there are things that legally we can't really talk about, but just a bit about the effect that it had on Westminster. I was surprised by how genuinely upsetting I found it. I don't know if you felt the same.
I mean, I think I wasn't surprised how upset I was in a way, in that although I didn't know her very well, that kind of development focused. Right of the Labour Party, centre-left kind of patch is a bit of the Labour Party I know very well. I've written a lot about the refugee crisis. So the fact that it appears to have partly been motivated by her politics, I think made it more visceral, because it felt more like, well, that could have been some of the MPs that I know very well, MPs who, I see socially, MPs who've been to my wedding or whatever. And because my partner works in politics, and you kind of take for granted in mainland Britain, then she has an 100% chance of coming home at the end of the day. I know it's incredibly self-centred to see it through that prism, but I think that was kind of the initial reaction.
I think for me it was a really strange day anyway, because the news broke initially that she was injured at about 1:45, 2 p.m. And then the England match almost immediately started. And so on Twitter particularly, it was a very strange mixture of people who hadn't quite got the news yet, or people who were tweeting about the football anyway, versus people who were sort of seeing this kind of unfolding story. And then I was walking by chance through the city, and it was that horrible pre-thunderstorm atmosphere, the very muggy but very oppressive and close. And then there was a group of very loud England fans, shouting and doing that slightly obnoxious victory thing, I thought, actually, I don't want to get on the tube. It was that sort of. It reminded me a bit after 7/7, where you just your own city kind of felt a bit strange to you again. In that sense, that, like you say, I felt less safe. And I know, again, it's a very self-indulgent reaction, but I imagine that's why it affected so many people, because it felt we didn't think we were that kind of country.
Yeah,
I think that's the fundamental thing. I think the decision to sustain campaigning until Sunday was the right one. I think it would have been impossible to carry on and make those arguments, while that period of kind of mourning was observed. It would have felt very tasteless indeed. And I would love to say that it looks like this week has started with a kind of more sober, fact-based approach to campaign. But I have to say that doesn't seem to necessarily have happened. So we've already had Penny Morden, who's an armed forces minister, who's on the Leave side, claiming that we don't have a veto against Turkey joining in the EU. Lots of people have told her that we do, and she's left that tweet up. Douglas Carswell, UKIP's only MP, saying that Viktor Orban, as a representative of Jobbik, the far-right party Jobbik, wants us to stay in the EU. Of course, he's not a member of Jobbik, and in fact Jobbik are quite Brexity, they're quite Eurosceptic. So there's just been two flagrant falsehoods already peddled, I thought. And I have to say that the other thing that really struck me about my own kind of reaction to Joe Cox's death is that I couldn't believe watching Cameron on Question Time with someone saying, "You're Neville Chamberlain, you're a bit," shouting at him. I just thought, I know that I think it's great that we live in a country where we don't, you know, tug our forelocks to politicians, but I think that's that kind of using politicians as your sort of punching bags verbally is, I find that a really, I don't know, I just find that really disrespectful actually to all the people who elected them.
But I also think then there's kind of a, once again, it's this language of traitors of the enemy within that is discomforting, to say the least. On the other hand, I'm always reluctant, yeah, kind of, we shouldn't forget the Nye Bevan described the Conservatives as lower than vermin. Winston Churchill warned that Attlee winning would lead to a Gestapo being formed in Britain. This was someone who'd fought a war with.
Godwin's law was in operation,
yeah,
even.
I mean, in some ways, I think then what's happened is then the wonderful thing about the internet is then we have got a much closer connection with our readers and listeners than any set of NS writers have ever had in the magazine's history, which is great 90% of the time, but obviously the other 10% of people are people who don't like black left-wingers or women left-wingers, etc., etc. But I think partly what's happened is that those people can be measured. Yeah, we can see them.
Which is ironic, given that the cry is often so much about not being heard. And I think a lot of people's sense of anger springs from the idea that no one's listening to them. And I don't actually necessarily think that that's an entirely wrong thing to say, because I think, for example, if you are somebody who cares, you know, for immigration is the biggest issue in your life, it's something that you absolutely care the most about, you know, if you live somewhere with very high rates of immigration that has driven down wages, or, you know, there is only seasonal work and it's being taken by other people, I kind of think that there isn't really an outlet for you in mainstream politics. I think that the Conservatives really are mostly responsible for failing those people by playing I'm talking about the Cameron strain of conservatism, very happy to talk a big tough game that was then not at all carried through. So no wonder people feel slightly betrayed on that.
Yeah, we also did see that from Labour last week with the Yvette Cooper's slightly mystifying intervention and this idea, we can look again at free movement.
We can look again at free movement. It's just that the other 27 countries in Europe will go, good, thanks for looking, but yeah. Nothing happening.
The thing is, there isn't quite nothing you could offer Poland or Lithuania that they would be willing to go to their own voters and say, by the way, we've made it harder for you to travel within the EU. However, there's nothing you could give the 2004 accession countries to make that worthwhile, then would be a price that Germany, France would be willing to pay. And to be honest, actually, I don't think would be a price that British voters would actually be willing to pay. I think people are right to feel that politicians have been misleading them about immigration. If you say, we'll vote to stay and then we'll look again at free movement, that's just a lie. It's not a lie which directly spreads division and fear of the other, like the 75 million Turks who are going to all get passports and rock up tomorrow and steal my job as special correspondent. But it's a lie nonetheless. And people do know that they are kind of being sold a pup and have been sold a false prospectus on our ability to control our borders for some time.
Okay, so let's zoom out slightly. What do you think will be the lasting, when this kind of period gets written up in history books, what would you think will be the defining thing that comes out of it? Have we actually learned anything during this referendum campaign that we didn't sort of know already?
The thing that historians are perhaps disproportionately obsessed with is beginnings and endings. When do you break up the 18th century? Yeah, when do periods,
the long 18th century,
begin and end? Because, and the interesting is also that is partly about apportioning blame. So this kind of divide that we've seen in the referendum, what Blair described as between open versus closed, you know, if depending on where you start, that depends on who you want to blame. You can start in 2004 with the accession of New Europe, the failure to spend adequate money in Boston or Peterborough, etc.
The lack of transitional controls, yeah, on people coming in from the new countries.
And then, of course, it's kind of Blair and Brown's fault. And I mean, obviously, it's broader than that. But yeah, you can go still further back to the fall of the Soviet Union and its satellite states and the failure to build adequate provisions. But wherever you start from at this point, I think we will look back, I think, at 2016, at a moment at which the hourglass economy, resentment towards migrants as the cause, in heavy inverted commas, of that injustice came to a head in a particularly nasty way, both in terms of the vocabulary used and some of the events outside of that.
So when you talk about the hourglass economy, that's the idea that jobs are now bunched, you know, there's a bunching at the bottom, right? And then at the top, and then actually the sort of solid middle class jobs that there once were that you just, you know, can have a support a nice lifestyle on are kind of going away. Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically the idea is that you have lots of very wealthy jobs at the top and very few kind of mid-ranking jobs, which you kind of see in... Yeah, so let's take, say, the average office, which even 10 years ago, someone might have had perhaps 10 secretaries, a couple of clerks. Now they may have one person as their legal desk.
And a computer.
A computer.
Yeah.
And then a cleaner. It's the problem of most startups, in that they have lots of very well-paid tech people, and then... people doing,
but also just fewer people generally. There's a bit in Andrew Keen's The Internet Is Not the Answer where he talks about the fact that, you know, Kodak had employed, you know, hundreds of people, and one of the big reasons that it went bust is the rise of things like Instagram, the photo sharing app, which I think at the time that it was bought out for whatever $1 billion had about 12 employees, you know. It's just the kind of the amount of value that you can extract from companies with far fewer employees is just extraordinary. Now, I know you spent this weekend in Hull, sunlit upland. Actually, I bet the weather was nicer in Hull than it was here.
Yeah, it was actually very good.
What was the mood like on the Hullian doorstep?
It was really interesting. So I was driven partly by Andy Burnham's sort of alliterative thing about Hampstead and Hull.
We speak too much to Hampstead and not enough to Hull.
In
was he talking specifically about Labour there, or was he talking about the general referendum campaign?
I think he was talking specifically about Labour and its approach to the referendum. I mean, so a couple of hostages to fortune. I know there have been a lot of, you know, the bookies are saying turnout of 80%. The Electoral Commission is comparing to that. Yeah, I don't buy that. The thing I found interesting is that I found it very hard not to compare it to when I was up in Glasgow immediately before the independent referendum, partly because in many ways Hull looks visually a lot like Glasgow or Bristol or Oxford. You have kind of an imperial city centre, sandstone monuments to the empire, outer ring of private housing built in the Baldwin government, and then dotted around all of that is council housing built after the Blitz by those post-war governments. The big difference is Hull, unlike Bristol or Glasgow or Oxford or Cambridge, hasn't had its kind of, well, I guess Oxford and Cambridge were never really dependent on the imperial economy, but hasn't had its second act economically, as it were. It hasn't had the moment where the jobs from the old world have vanished and they've been replaced by equally dignified work for most people. There's still actually a lot of manufacturing in Hull, but it doesn't employ very many people because of technological change. And the interesting thing is, it is, as all the polls say, a much more Eurosceptic than most of the places I visited during the referendum campaign. But I think, another hostage to fortune, I think this idea that the referendum is going to reconfigure politics to UKIP's benefit in the event of a Remain vote, based on Hull, I would have liked to have time to go to Sunderland as well, but
I also don't know whether or not it's going to reconfigure politics to UKIP's benefit, rather than a more general Eurosceptic or nationalist feeling, if we vote out. Because I wonder, in the same problem as, you know, the Conservatives got crushed by the coalition, you know, if once you get what you want, you can't be peddling a kind of grievance politics. It's at that point, it's kind of, well, you know, where's all this stuff you promised us?
I know, so I think Remain is actually, Leave is actually the best scenario for UKIP. Because Vote Leave are running on an entirely fictitious manifesto. If you compare it to Scotland's white paper, yes, some of the sums in that you can say were a bit optimistic, but ultimately there was a plan there, which if you were a civil servant in the Scottish government, you could have come in the next day and gone, right, okay, and you could have implemented something like that, at least something which most reasonable people would look around and go, okay, you've tried. We didn't get everything in it, but you've tried. Whereas Vote Leave are basically offering a version of exit from the EU that is not on the table and will never be on the table. Whatever happens, and my guess is, to be honest, what will happen is we will end up in some kind of EEA Norway-style arrangement where the City of London keeps its financial passports, etc., etc. We accept a far smaller level of opt-outs and are much more of a supplicant towards the European Union.
And we no longer get a veto on Turkey joining the EU,
ironically.
And we
no longer get a veto on Turkey joining
the EU. Despite having probably having free movement.
Yeah, so we would... And I think at that point, I think there's an idea at the top of Vote Leave and among a lot of conservative Brexit-backing MPs that they can run a campaign on the dangers of the Turks, on the awfulness of immigration, and then they can turn around and go, surprise, we're going to keep free movement, we're just going to regulate workplace rights less. And then they can do this and there won't be political repercussions for that action. I think UKIP will do very well in that scenario.
Because it seemed to be the Conservative government that's failing on all the promises. Yeah. And UKIP will say, well, we had the one true flame, we've been betrayed. And as we all know, nothing gets people going like a civil war.
Yeah. Whereas I think in a Remain vote, sooner rather than later, Cameron will be replaced by a Brexiter. And my instinct is what will happen is it will be quite good news for the right. But I think then they will actually do a better job of eating UKIP under a pro-Brexit Prime Minister.
One of the things I thought was interesting about the reaction to on Thursday afternoon after the killing of Jo Cox was that Theresa May came out of the Home Office to make a very short statement, which I thought she did well. And actually, I thought Cameron did his statement well. Jeremy Corbyn's written statement was better than his clip for the TV cameras. I thought it was a nice tribute. But it did make me feel, I don't know how many other people felt, that's the kind of time when you want a grown-up. And actually, I think when you think about Boris Johnson, I just don't know how well he would do those moments. And I wonder whether or not at some point, when as the prospect of Prime Minister Boris Johnson hoves closer, people sort of think, it's all very well, but, you know, will he do the state funeral? Will he do the, you know, like Tony Blair's post-Princess Diana moment? You know, can he do the set pieces that demand gravitas?
I think he can, partly because, I have a problem, and I think I've probably said this before, but I'm going to bore our listeners with it again, in that I find it so hard to see the appeal of Boris, and I am always really reluctant to say, oh, yeah, this is the moment when he's going to come unstuck, because I've just never got it. Mm-hmm. And I have to plead ignorance on that one. But this is someone who is incredibly cunning, who works awfully hard to look like a shambling, improvisational politician. I think if he needs to, and I mean, you remember in 2008 when he kind of briefly rebranded himself as a serious politician to take on Ken Livingstone, and they had actually a range of fairly terrible policies in terms of their consequences for London and clean air, but in terms of the demographics he needed to win over to win that mayoral election, he was a ruthless operator in the 2008 election. I think he'll probably find a way to do that again. I think he will. Yeah, I think his capacity for regeneration has surprised people before. It certainly surprised me. I think there's an element, we know this exists within political journalism, of people who are nice about power, whether that's the Labour leadership or the Conservative leadership, whether they're in or out of opposition, in order to get stories and exclusives from them. I think Boris will so much be the coming force that he will get soft-soaped by most of the right-wing press, which will make it harder for those flaws to become apparent. I think you're right, then there is potentially a problem for him that he can't...
Well, you're right, he would have to tack back to serious again. Yeah. You know, during this referendum campaign, he's been sort of brandishing pasties and saying things that are slightly, you know, outrageous, and I think he's probably would then have to veer back towards the sober again, as it were.
I think also that the advantage he has, perhaps, you know, we don't know how long, if we do stay in, touch wood, than Cameron lasts. Yeah, we probably will have another recession. We've had a referendum campaign which was pretty grim even before
Sorry, it's just everything's so miserable. I was listening to a podcast about antimicrobial resistance on the way in, and at the end they ask all the scientists, like, you know, are you worried about this? And they'll go, I'm terrified. Yeah, I'm really terrified.
But
the world seems very, then, very scary right
there
now.
There may be an element that Boris is like, ha ha ha, only me kind of thing, might actually cheer up people.
Well, there we are. Maybe if we win the Euros and we do really well at the Olympics, we'll get a bit of optimism back. Well, that's it for us for now.
Hi. Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now it's time to go down the line to the lobby with George.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George.
So Jeremy Corbyn made his one and only major TV appearance of the EU referendum campaign yesterday. And while it helped confirm that he's not a secret Brexiter, as some have wrongly claimed, it did show that he's the most reluctant of Remainers. He said he didn't love the European Union. He said at one point there would be implications from Remain, there would be massive implications from Leave. He often sounded like a rather dispassionate teacher as opposed to a campaigning leader a few days before one of the biggest votes in the UK's history.
Yeah. In terms of the balancing act within his own party, has he done enough to escape finger-pointing and kvetching should Britain leave the EU on Thursday?
I don't think he's done enough to escape it. I think he's done enough to limit it. He has been, most of the time, fairly unambiguous in putting the case for Remain. He is clearly passionate about workers' rights and about what he calls building a Europe of solidarity in alliance with other left-wing leaders. But he will be charged with a lack of enthusiasm. That's fairly clear. And also, I think, for downplaying the economic warnings from Remain. So yesterday, for instance, he said that he refused to endorse George Osborne's warning that Brexit would hit the poorest hardest. Whereas Ed Miliband, by contrast, the SNP, they have been warning their voters that a Tory Brexit would mean spending cuts and tax rises for them. And Remain obviously consider that a much more effective approach.
If we stay, how long can Cameron stick around in that situation?
I think he'll find it hard to last much beyond 2018 at best. He's already said that he's not going to fight another election. We know from history, contrast Tony Blair and Harold Wilson, that when you say you're going to resign, your authority erodes at an accelerated rate. The Tories will get increasingly restless. Some will want an early election to take advantage of Labour's weakness. And also, once the referendum's over, there's no great project which David Cameron has lined up to justify him staying for until 2019, say. He has what he calls his One Nation agenda, but in the view of many, particularly in the Leave camp, the Queen's speech was really pretty thin gruel.
Right. And if we leave, will his feet not touch the ground? How long can he last in that scenario?
I think he'd be gone by the end of the year at the latest. I don't think he'd go immediately. I think he would feel it was his duty to remain for the sake of stability, and I think the Leavers would actually quite happily have some time to plan their approach. But I don't think Tory MPs would allow someone who'd campaigned for Remain, especially as vigorously as David Cameron has, to then lead the process of negotiating Britain's withdrawal. I just don't think that's an option.
And on the subject of other people's political futures after Remain, Michael Gove said he might resign if Britain votes to stay. So a nice 2-for-1 bonus there for many of our listeners. What are you hearing about the shape of Cameron's post-Remain cabinet?
So there's not likely to be a reshuffle until the autumn because David Cameron wants to give Tory MPs an incentive to behave themselves over the summer. My guess is that it will be somewhere in between. It won't be a full purge, but it won't be entirely conciliatory. He will take the chance to get rid of some of the Brexiters, particularly those who've overreached themselves during the campaign. He will reward those who have been, in Downing Street's eyes, well-behaved, such as Chris Grayling, Theresa Villiers, Andrea Leadsom, James Wharton. The big question, of course, is whether he retains Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, and if so, at what level?
Other than Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, who else is on the naughty step as far as Downing Street is concerned from the Brexit side?
Penny Mordaunt, who obviously denied that the UK had a veto over Turkey. Priti Patel has launched some remarkably fierce attacks on David Cameron. But from a Leave perspective, the man who's on the naughty step is George Osborne, and he, of course, has been for some time for many Tories. So perhaps the biggest decision that Cameron has to take is whether to keep Osborne at the Treasury or perhaps to replace him with Theresa May, a reluctant Remainer, someone who's taken a deliberately consensual approach. And on the Remain side, there's some who think it would be in Osborne's interests to actually move away from the Treasury to the Foreign Office, because although he'll be away from Westminster, he won't be able to immerse himself in the game playing that he so loves. It will free him from the desire to bear responsibility for austerity, which, as we've seen in just a year, has dramatically eroded his leadership hopes.
Right, and we'll be back to discuss the fallout from the vote, whatever it happens, in a Friday, in a special edition.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Now it's time for You Ask Us. We've decided to be very brave and tackle the question we've got from a lot of people this week, even though the potential for egg on our faces is large, which is, what do we think will happen on Thursday? Helen, you first.
Well, I have very sensibly not said anything or made any kind of prediction, because I just think the rewards for getting it right are nothing compared to the egg. And I'm very sensitive about the egg. But I have to say, secretly, I confess that all the way through, I have thought it would be Remain, simply because I think that the economic message is one that is really powerful. If you think about the fact that David Cameron, although people might now think he's a bit boring and dull and the lobby consensus is, you know, he's a fading star, he is still a prime minister who won an overall majority that no one expected him to win only 12 months ago. So clearly people don't hate him that much. And my feeling was that, you know, a lot of people will take the opportunity in the polls, I think, as Peter Kellner wrote for us, to, you know, a couple of weeks out, it's basically, do you want to kick the government? And people go, yes, I want to kick the government. But then as things get closer to polling day, people begin to really think about their mortgage, their pension. You know, is the situation currently so intolerable that they're willing to take a risk on the outcome? And, you know, I felt like at the last election, Labour's sort of basic premise was, you know, the austerity's been really horrible, you're all suffering, time to change the government and vote for Labour. And the sense that I found places that I went in the country that were Tory Labour marginals was that people said, well, the recession's been bad, but actually we're on the way back up. No, things aren't bad enough for us to want to gamble on changing stuff. And I sort of feel that's still the same now. But you've been very Brexity all year.
Yeah, so I've been very pessimistic about the referendum. Since January, I've thought that we were on a trajectory to leave the European Union. But I'm actually going to...
You're going to recant?
I'm recanting, yeah. I've actually done a U-turn because over the last couple of weeks, I've been out and about an awful lot around very different bits of the country, including places where, according to the polls, we expect Remain to do fairly badly. And from lots of people, you know, different ages, different groups, but all people you'd expect to trend towards Brexit. Yeah, all of the stuff about immigration, all of those worries. But then they go, but I don't really think that would change in Brexit. And then you hear again, I'm worried about my house price. And I think we forget, particularly in London, where getting on the housing market is such a distant dream for so many people, we forget that, you know, 40% of the country is still an owner-occupier with a mortgage, 20% still is an owner-occupier, and actually if you want to sell your house, even if you aren't worried about negative equity, you're still not that wild about the price going down.
And about interest rates going up as well.
Rate, yeah.
So, I mean, Mark Carney didn't make his Mansion House speech in the end, but there have been previous worries about inflation, and then which would then need to be controlled by a rise in interest rates. And, you know, for every half point that base rate goes up, a lot of people's mortgages slip away. I think you wrote about buy-to-letters and the fact that that might be drastically undercounted because, you know, that the idea is that people have one buy-to-let mortgage. Well, actually, some people have several
lots,
with different...
several banks, and the estimate is a third... I know many
a third
of
buy to let mortgage holders
would
wouldn't be
underwater,
able to.
And which I know a lot of our listeners will go, oh, that's brilliant. I would be able to buy a flat. I'm afraid you would not, because one, the banks would suddenly go, whoa, I'm not, that was awful. I'm not lending to anyone else. The second is a lot of people would be in negative equity, so they wouldn't be able to sell their houses because they would not pay off the mortgage. What they would have to do is they would hike rents, or some of them would be repossessed, which again would then likely be bought at a knockdown price by more cash buyers. So I'm afraid that it would not solve the problem, the housing problem, for people who can't get on the ladder.
But that's my prediction, and I'm very willing to be proved wrong, because it has been Vote Leave have fought an incredibly dirty but effective campaign. Their messages have been very disciplined. Things have been cut through. You know, I had a letter that came into the magazine this week that said, you know, we've got to take control. Mm. And I thought, oh, hello, that's, you know, that is that line directly from their branding. So, you know, they have had cut through with stuff, and they have been very, I don't like the way they've gone about it, but they have been very effective and very focused. So I wouldn't, you know, I'm not eating my hat stage if it turns out we do vote to leave.
I mean, if we vote to leave, I will find it very hard to understand why people felt that was the right decision, but I will understand the process and the campaign and why all of that happened.
I will also groan horribly, because our lives are going to be very busy and full of even more Tory infighting, something which I'm not looking forward to covering in more detail over the summer.
Yeah, and then the recession and, oh God. Yeah, I mean, but I do sort of feel like things are moving in a positive direction for Remain. I did feel out and about over the last couple of weeks. I have started to feel a mood in the air, in the same way that when I was in the Vale of Glamorgan or whatever, you could feel a mood in the air of people kind of going, oh, we know Ed Miliband's had a hard time from the press, so we'll take a look for him ourselves. But actually, we've decided he's not up to it. And I feel there's an element of people going, we are angry about immigration. We don't like any of this, but actually we are worried about the economic hit. So I think it's going to be Remain.
And that means that probably Daniel Hannan, Chris Grayling, Ian Duncan Smith, Nigel Farage, Douglas Carswell will all be getting fewer TV bookings from now on, which is obviously something that I personally feel very sad about.
We'll find a way to struggle through, I'm sure.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.